From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott.
The American economy.
Climate change without.
Hacking.
Different religions in it.
Sustainability.
Social media.
Security. Freedom.
Technology.
Marriage.
Ethics.
Privacy.
Our Rethink 2014 series continues with some new thinking about sex and relationships and warning to parents of children or other sensitive people. We are going to acknowledge the existence of sex in this interview. For centuries, marriage functioned as a political, practical, and economical union, depending on your station in life. For aristocrats, a good marriage secured fortunes and positions. For common folk, it meant having enough kids to work a farm. It's only in the last 100 years or so that the idea of a passionate marriage took hold of popular imagination. Today, most of us are less worried about basic survival and can focus more on what we desire in a union, usually a healthy, dynamic, secure relationship that is predictable. Except when it comes to sex, which people want to be anything but staid and predictable. We got a lot of information on that from Esther Perel. She's based her career on how to unite those conflicting desires. She's a psychologist, sex therapist, and author who specializes in couples and sexuality. Her TED Talk on the secret to desire in a long-term relationship has received well over 2 million views, and her best-selling book is called Mating in Captivity, Unlocking Erotic Intelligence. And she joins us now on the line via Skype. And Esther, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Yes, thank you. It's a pleasure to be there.
So you're a leader in the field of couples therapy. What do you think are the most frequent problems you encounter with marriages today?
I would say that never before have we invested more in love as a part of marriage, as a constitutive part of marriage, and never have we divorced more in the name of the absence of that love. We have piled up expectations that we try to meet with one person to the extent that relationships sometimes crumble under the amount of expectations. We are asking one person to give us what we've always expected from long-term relationships or marriages: security, family life, companionship, social status, economic support. And we want that same person to also be our best friend and our trusted confidant and our passionate lover to boot. And we live twice as long. And that's a tall order for a party of two.
Yeah, that's an awful lot to put on a relationship. So there's this tension that a lot of couples have. What's driving that?
A few things are driving it, right? We are living in the West in a free world in which we have a market economy that doesn't just apply to finance, but also to romantic relationships, and in which the values of freedom and autonomy have become ultimate. We have today this concept of a passionate marriage, which used to be a contradiction in terms. Marriage was here and passion pretty much a privilege mostly for men that could experience it with far more safety than women, for whom the consequences were dire. And we want today one person and one relationship to give us two fundamental sets of human needs that are actually rather opposite and that spring from different sources and pull us in different directions, which is our need for security and our need for adventure. Or in systemic language, our need for stability and our need for growth and change. Mm. This is the first time in the history of humankind where we have sex not because we want multiple children or because it's exclusively a woman's marital duty. We want sex that is rooted in desire, that is the sovereign expression of our free will. I want it.
So how do you keep that desire alive when you have kids and a job and you're exhausted and you've made dinner and done dishes and get the kids bathed and negotiate all of these different responsibilities that stifle eroticism?
Or one could say they may not necessarily stifle the erotic, but they displace it. If you look at many modern families, I would say that often the erotic energy is alive and well. But for that, you have to think of eroticism not as sex and the narrow meaning that we have attributed to the erotic. If you think about novelty, imagination, playfulness, curiosity, mystery, as essential erotic ingredients, they are all present in a family with children, but it's often eros redirected. The kids get novel activities and the couple does the same old, same old. The kids get to have multiple play dates and the couple will have an anniversary and a birthday. The question then becomes, how do people bring some of that energy back to the couple, and why does it matter? It matters because for most couples in the West today, the survival of the family depends on the reasonable contentment of the couple. So on the long list of what your children need, a couple that has an erotic bond should feature as one of the main items.
Mm. It sounds to me like that's about intimacy. That's about living a life together. But you write that intimacy doesn't necessarily mean good sex. And I'd love to hear more about that, because current thinking tells us that the two are intrinsically combined. I mean, it sounds like what couples therapists say to keep people together.
Yes. For me, intimacy, first of all, is a concept that has profoundly changed its meaning. It used to be a convivencia, a living together, a sharing of the daily, a raising of the children, a working of the land, attachment and habit. Intimacy today is a deep experience of recognition of my individuality, of my authentic self, for which you are going to be a validating, reflective listener that's going to help me transcend my existential aloneness. That is a very different kind of intimacy. Now, its connection to sexuality is highly questioned. If mutuality and reciprocity and protection and worry about the well-being of our partner and a sense of responsibility are part of the experience of love, then sometimes the very experience of responsibility, worry, and protection can be sexually deflating.
Your concept of intimacy also involves an idea of privacy. So tell us a little bit about this idea of personal intimacy.
Personal intimacy is the experience of interiority, of an inner world with oneself. What's interesting is that we live in the age of transparency, in which the same concept of intimacy has become equated with transparent, with wholesale sharing. We are close because we can tell each other everything, rather than we are close maybe because we don't have to tell each other everything, because we know that we have worlds and parts of us that remain personal and private. And a lot of this is very cultural. America definitely is on the far end of the transparency model, to the point where privacy has often been corroded and we experience two extremes, either secrecy or transparency. Mm-hmm. If you keep it to yourself, it means you don't trust me. It means, you're hiding something from me. Otherwise, if you're close, there wouldn't be anything that you wouldn't want to share with me. And it becomes a whole tautology like that.
We're speaking with the psychologist and author Esther Perel about how to keep long-term relationships fresh, let's say, and healthy. Esther, you talked about the importance of personal intimacy. But what about using that concept as a right to unmitigated privacy or a justification for having an affair? Are you saying in some cases that infidelity can be okay?
Look, the question of what is separate and what is together is a fundamental question that belongs to the making of any couple. Every couple decides what is separate and what is common, what thoughts need to be shared, what finances need to be shared, what fantasies can need to be shared, and what remains personal, what friends can remain your own and what friends have to be joined, what movies you can see on your own, or if you have to see only the movies that both of us want to see. This is an organizing principle of any intimate relationship. The difference between heterosexual couples maybe and homosexual couples is that in straight couples, there is an assumption that is made up front so that the question is rarely negotiated, certainly not in the sexual realm, because that threatens the sacred ideal of the romantic myth. What you're asking me is to take something that is a lot more ambiguous and a lot more complex and make determinations that have never been able to be made. Adultery has existed forever since marriage came along. It is so central that even the Bible knew to repeat it twice in the Ten Commandments, once for doing it and once just for thinking about it. So maybe we're not facing such a new reality after all.
Mm. Let's talk about something a little more concrete that you found from people when you traveled around the world on your book tour and asked people, when do you find yourself most drawn to your partner? I'm interested to hear what you found.
You know, it's a question that I originally asked. I've asked it in about 22 countries. Mating in Captivity is translated in about 25 languages. And I thought there must be major cultural differences. And except for one answer that is gender-based, which is when the women say, when I see him playing with the children, which is very sexy and not the other way around, none of the answers are gender-bound. They cross back and forth. But they basically organize themselves in four groups of answers. One would be when I am separated from my partner, when he or she is away, when we reunite, mm-hmm. highlighting the notion that desire also is rooted in absence and in longing. So that's the first group of answers, which we could elaborate. The second one was when I see my partner doing something that he or she is competent about, passionate about, in their element, self-sufficient. Basically, when I see my partner as an other, separate from me, that I do not need to take care of. And that experience of a radiant other, where there is no caretaking and no sense of responsibility, is highly charged with attraction, with desire, with admiration, which is an essential element of desire. The third group was when he or she or I, when we surprise each other, highlighting the notion of novelty, of breaking of routine, of the eruption of desire. And surprise could be going and doing something that's different from the usual, or seeing my partner as vulnerable, not because vulnerability is so attractive, but because I don't typically get to see my partner in that space. And then the other one was when we're on vacation, when the kids are not there, basically highlighting the playfulness, the open-endedness, the non-productive nature of erotic sex. Of erotic sex meaning sexuality that is transformed by our imagination, or the poetics of sex, basically. So these groups began to highlight that you look at this person that's already so familiar, and momentarily they are once again somewhat mysterious, somewhat unknown, somewhat elusive. And in that space between me and the other lies the erotic elan.
Mm. So Esther Perel, with those things in mind, does a perfect marriage exist, or what does a really great marriage look like to you?
I don't think I ever would apply the word perfect to marriage, but then I won't necessarily apply to that many things as well. I think the question that I would like to ask is, when you look around, what is an inspired relationship for you? How many people around you do you know that you find inspire you, that have a certain spark? You know, we often allow marriages to exist in ways that we wouldn't allow a single other systems, organization, or living organism to actually survive on this planet. Mm. We don't invest nearly as much in our relationships as we will invest in our businesses, in our houses. You know, the wedding contract is nothing compared to a business contract. So my question is, a couple that feels alive, when I went around and asked, it's not about separate people living separate life at all, but it is about people who have a fundamental respect for the freedom, the existential freedom of another person. That is not the freedom to cheat and all of that, but basically the sense that you don't confuse intimacy with surveillance, and you don't confuse intimacy with fusion. It is a relationship where two people are able to continue to grow. You know, we used to die 7 years after we were done raising our kids. Today we have this phase where we say, is this it? And that thirst for feeling alive, which means that there is still surprise to come, that new things can still emerge, new experience we haven't known, that is what keeps us on the edge of our seats. It is the difference between not being dead and being alive. And I think that a thriving relationship very much focuses on that distinction.
Well, thank you for all of the surprises and inspiration today, Esther Perel. Really appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
Esther Perel, a psychotherapist and author who specializes in couples and sexuality. You can find more on her best-selling book, Mating in Captivity, Unlocking Erotic Intelligence, or a link to watch her TED Talk and much more at wordofmouthradio.org.
My funny Valentine, sweet comic Valentine, you make me smile with my heart.
A search for marriage proposals on YouTube will get you thousands of over-the-top stagings of popping the question. There's lots of song, dance, choreography, and plenty of tears. Among the most popular is Isaac's live lip-sync proposal, which has nearly 25 million views. What goes into making a viral proposal video? Turns out, quite a lot. Alexander Ward brings us the story.
This past May, my longtime friend Isaac decided to propose to his girlfriend Amy. Professionally, Isaac is an actor and a director in both theater and film, and personally, he's a wonderful storyteller and the sort of person that when he's around, I'm usually laughing. So I was honored when he asked me to film his proposal, and after telling me his idea, I was sure it would be a big hit with his family and friends. But little did I know just how huge it would become. I recently went over to Isaac's place to talk to him about the experience. Here's Isaac.
For some, that excitement of suddenly he's down on his knee and, you know, that sort of romantic excitement, that thrill, was going to be a little bit absent in our proposal because we talked about it. So I wanted, how could I, like, inject a little magic back into the thing?
Isaac's idea? A live lip dub proposal. And for those of you that don't know what a lip dub is, it's basically a person or a group of people making a music video to a song where they just lip sync the words.
So I spent, a while just kind of being fascinated by the idea of just the lip dub at all. And then just being in this place where I was looking for a creative way to ask. It just kind of was like kismet, you know, in my brain, the two ideas just kind of collided.
So here's how Isaac pulls off his proposal. He calls Amy and tells her to come to his parents' house for dinner. When she arrives, Isaac's older brother, Connor, meets her in the driveway and sits her down in the backseat of a car. She's facing out the back while one of Isaac's friends begins to drive slowly forward. The song Marry You by Bruno Mars starts playing over the speakers. Isaac's best friends and his parents then come out from behind the car and begin performing the song in front of her. As the song progresses and the car moves down the street, more and more people come out of their hiding places to join the show. And there are lots of people, over 60 friends and family members, involved in the performance. It slowly crescendos into a huge group of people, some even in costume, singing and doing choreographed dances. There's even a marching band. Then the song ends, the crowd parts, and Isaac is standing there in a suit, ready to walk forward and pop the question.
You have already given me a lifetime of happiness. Will you let me spend the rest of my life trying to give you the same? Will you marry me?
The proposal goes off without a hitch. Amy says yes, and it's a wonderful time for everyone involved. The job is done, and it's a smashing success. But then, just like Amy sitting in the back of the car, nobody saw what was coming next. Just days later, this great moment we all shared became something else entirely. It took on a life of its own.
It happened on a Wednesday. I put it together on Thursday, and I posted it Friday morning. And we were in New York on the Today Show on Monday.
Back now at 8:19 with one of the most creative marriage proposals we've ever seen. Isaac Lamb popped the question to his girlfriend Amy Frankel last week in what he billed as the first live lip dub proposal. It already has more than 5 million hits online, 60 of the couple's family and friends surprised.
This morning I ran the numbers on all the websites the video was posted, and it's just over 22 million views. It seems like most viral videos are founded on either silly humor, a shocking incident, or a massive pop song. But it's rare that a viral video, like Isaac's, genuinely connects with people's emotion.
So I think people, when people see that in a genuine way in the world, that many people excited and in love with a couple and wanting to celebrate that huge moment in their lives with them, I think there's already, you're already like in an emotional place. You're going to get people to react to it. You're going to get them hooked.
If the success and depth of their proposal is any indication of their marriage, I'd have to say they're in for a spectacular life.
Radio producer and reporter Alexander Ward there. If you'd like to see Isaac's proposal for yourself, you can find a link at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Up next, we continue our Rethink 2014 series with Paying for Music. We'll hear from a songwriter who may have figured out how to game the Spotify system. That's when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. It's the axiom of the era. You can find anything on the internet for free. The challenge has been figuring out how artists, writers, and musicians and content makers get paid for their work. Take the music streaming service Spotify. Sure, users can discover new artists and find a lot of great music. But Spotify is under fire for failing to compensate the artists who make that music. In an opinion piece for The Guardian last October, David Byrne wrote, "If artists have to rely almost exclusively on the income from these services, they will be out of work within a year." Maybe the big-name musicians have it all wrong. We bring you the story of an unknown songwriter who's raking in the Spotify royalty checks, one song at a time. PJ Vogt of On the Media's new TLDR podcast and blog has the story.
20% of the songs on Spotify have never been played. That's 4 million songs that have been so thoroughly orphaned that even their creators couldn't be bothered to play through them just once. There's a good chance that at least some of these were written by a guy named Matt Farley. Matt records in his basement in Danvers, Massachusetts. For work, he does 2 long shifts at a group home every week, and that lets him spend the other 4 days just writing songs. When his wife, Elizabeth, comes home from work, she'll sometimes just stand upstairs and eavesdrop.
She likes to not tell me when she's coming home so that she can come home and hear, you know, honk, honk, honk goes the horn, beep, 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 honk your horn. And then, like, I hear footsteps. I'm like, are you home? She's like, I like your new song, and I'm totally embarrassed.
Matt's clean cut and tall. He looks like he could model an airline neck pillow in a catalog. And his house is like any suburban house you've ever seen. Until you go down into that basement, which really is like a secret laboratory, where he's inventing a million weird bands that are really just him churning out song after song after song. Since he started in 2008, he's recorded more than 14,000 songs. He can do 100 on a good day. And he's recorded 4,250 happy birthday songs alone.
Hey, Alex. Hey there, Alex. Alex, Alex, Alex. It's your birthday. You probably knew that, Ann. You probably knew that, Ann. Because after all, Ann. It's your birthday. Happy birthday, Guadalupe. Guadalupe, it's your birthday. Happy birthday, Guadalupe.
Matt's latest album is about transportation. That's where that honk, honk, honk goes the horn, beep, beep, beep lyric comes from. This is not an album about problems with transportation or about something that happened while someone was transporting from one place to the other. It's an album about transportation, the noun. He lets me peek at his notes.
Right, so this is just, it's a notepad with every car, truck, motorcycle, tractor, trailer, camper, van, minivan, van, bicycle, tricycle, train, subway, taxi, cab.
Matt has pages and pages filled with columns of song ideas. And by ideas, I mean words.
Coming up, a little preview. Oh, the clothing album is going to be so good. Boots, shoes, sneakers, high heels. The body parts album, foot, toes, ankle, big toe, pinky toe, middle toe, Achilles tendon.
All right, so this is something you need to understand about Matt. All his life, Matt has made slightly arbitrary choices and then committed to them hard. Like, in fifth grade, when his friend started swearing, he thought it'd be funnier to not swear. So he didn't. And he still won't. Or, he really likes walking. So last year, he walked from his house in Danvers to the Boston Marathon, which means he basically walked the length of a marathon to just go watch a marathon. He also publishes a monthly newsletter about long walks, which is handwritten. When he does something, he does it big, including the music.
So I have a band called the Toilet Bowl Cleaners, And there's 8 albums of poop songs. You'd think I would run out, but the most recent one is like my pet sounds of poop songs. It's intense. It's beautiful.
What's it called?
It's called You Thought We Ran Out of Poop Song Ideas. You Were Wrong. Like, at first, it's just the poop song, you know, where I just sing the word poop.
Poop, 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 poop.
And that's a little frustrating because the poop song where I sing the word poop is the number one song. All I do is sing poop, 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 you know?
Yeah.
And then there's others where I write what I consider to be good music and clever lyrics, and they do well enough, but it's like, geez. But it's getting a little more abstract. You know, Poop Into a Wormhole is one of my favorite new tracks, and it's fantastic.
When you play a song on Spotify or on iTunes, the musician gets a tiny royalty. And a lot of them are angry about how bad the pay is. Matt's not. Matt's secret is that even if none of his songs are ever hits, he can still make half a living because there's just so many of them. And a lot of them are about things that people tend to search for online. So he's got kind of a song for everybody.
Liberals love criminals, everybody knows. They love to help them get out on parole.
That's a song by Matt's band, the Ultra Right Wing Conservatives.
Big government is good. We need more programs. We need to hire more people to work for these programs.
That, of course, is the extreme left wing liberals.
Who's gonna be pitching last? The man with the great, great stash. The man they call the axe. John Axford.
And that, of course, is from the Green Bay and Milwaukee sports band.
Facial hair, and so they're unaware of strikes whizzing by them.
My standard is if a song earns me $2 in a year, then I'm doing well. There's plenty of songs that make 3 cents a year, but, you know, it all averages out, and I'm up to 14,000.
So if on average, if you have 14,000 songs, are you making like $28,000 a year on royalties?
This year was 23,000. You know, I'm hoping for 25, 26 next year, which would be nice.
That's great.
Yeah.
One of the things about staring at the internet all day is you can have this feeling of being overwhelmed by just how much, like, content there is. How much crap. How many tiny things made by people to grab your attention for 1 second that no one's ever loved or cared about. And Matt's music should be like that. He writes songs about everything that people search for to make a tiny bit of money to make a living. But for some reason, when you find one of his songs, it feels specific and tailored and made for you, even though his process really is completely impersonal.
My newest thing that I just released is an album called Songs About Things in My House. And like, there's the door song, the window song, the stove, the refrigerator, and so on and so forth. And I was cracking up.
Wait, but that feels like one that wouldn't do super well.
Yeah, but it just got put out a week ago, and the song about my hot water heater sold. Hot water heater! Someone actually spent 99 cents on that.
A lot of the reason that Matt makes art is to connect with people. Artists say that line all the time, but with Matt, it's literal. He puts his phone number in his songs, and strangers call.
At least once a day. I got to turn the phone off overnight, my wife insists, because I would be so excited at 3 in the morning to get a call. Hey, are you the guy from the song? I'm like, yeah, I am. And I'll talk their ear off. What's funny is also they end up ending the phone. You know, usually it's like the person is the one who's like, look, I don't have time for you. I got to go. And in fact, it usually goes the other way. We're like, well, I guess that's all I want to know. I got to go now. I'm like, okay, thanks. Bye.
So this is the question that everybody asked me when I told them about Matt. I felt really uncomfortable asking it, which I think you can hear in the tape.
Well, it's just, I guess, like, so when I was talking to friends about this, they'd be like, the question I would ask would immediately be like, either are the songs good? Yeah. I mean, it's weird. What would you say to that?
I would say some of them are good because they're good. They're definitely catchy. Plenty of them are terrible, but the fact that they exist is wonderful. I would like it if someone else was doing what I was doing. So therefore, I'm doing it for anyone else out there like me.
When I talked to Matt, it was 2 days before Christmas, and I still hadn't bought a present for either of my step-parents. It's really hard to buy presents for your step-parents. So I asked Matt if he wouldn't mind writing songs for them. Here's what I get for Nan.
Short for Nancy?
for Diana.
Okay.
My dad's wife.
You could do Diana too, or you could do that either way.
Let's go with Nan. I like Nan.
She likes going to New York City, and she has a bunch of stray cats called Lolos that she feeds, and the neighbors are really mad about. And she drinks white wine, and she's really thoughtful at buying people presents, which is why I've been freaking out about getting her a Christmas present.
What does she call you? Should I mention you in the
story? Yeah, yeah. She calls me PJ.
Okay. White wine, thoughtful gift giver.
Yeah, and she really loves her kids. Is that too much stuff?
Yeah. Yeah, let me just think of some chords here.
Yeah.
All right.
All right.
Merry Christmas, Nan. Nan who loves to go to NYC. Nan, keep on feeding those Lolos, even though the neighbors say no, no. Merry Christmas, Nan. Sitting back with a glass of white wine. Merry Christmas, Nan. You always know just what kind of gift to get for PJ, and PJ was thinking that maybe it was time you deserved a song. Merry Christmas, Nan.
I drive back to Pennsylvania for Christmas and spend 2 days just totally psyched to have this song. I play it for friends off my giant tape recorder, none of whom find it as charming as I do. It's like playing a recording of a stranger doing karaoke. But then on Christmas Day, I play it for Nan, and she grins from ear to ear. She makes me play it again and again, and she asks me to email it to her and reminds me not to forget.
PJ Vogt there with a story from On the Media's new podcast and blog, TLDR. And if you're like me and had no idea what that means, I'm told it's too long, didn't read. There's a link to hear all of the TLDR episodes at wordofmouthradio.org. And we're going to stick to the musical beat with an exploration of music, emotion, and the human brain. That's after the news from NHPR.
Word of mouth.
Sunshine, lollipops, and rainbows. Everything that's wonderful is what I feel when we're together.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Wherever you live, whatever you're into, human beings respond to music. Brain researchers have found that listening to music doesn't only make you feel good, it alters your brain physiologically. Dr. Robert Zatorre is a neuroscientist at the Montreal Neurological Institute at McGill University. He has been studying the ways that music directly affects the brain. Dr. Zatorre, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hello, Virginia.
So what's happening in the brain when someone is listening to their favorite music?
Really, a whole lot of different things are happening, which is part of what makes it really quite fascinating to study. But perhaps I can focus on the aspect which most people find the most relevant, which is that when you listen to a piece of music that you really like, that you love, it really makes you feel very good. Pleasurable music activates a system in the brain that we call the dopamine system. And this is a system which is associated with positive reinforcement or reward, as well as learning and other positive mood effects.
So it feels good. How did you know which music to play while you were experimenting with people? And how were you able to study the reactions in the brain?
So we used a technique called positron emission tomography, which is a way of measuring brain chemistry, basically. And this allows us to pinpoint not only which chemical is active, but also where in the brain it's active. And we took our participants, who were just healthy, normal, average people. We just asked them, "Well, what's your favorite music?" If I'm being scanned, I would use, you know, my favorite music as the experimental condition, and it might use your favorite music as the control condition.
Mm-hmm.
And for you, it'd be vice versa, because you don't necessarily like what I would like, and other way around. So that's how we did the study.
Have you ever discovered any universals, however, about what sorts of music people do or don't derive pleasure from?
Well, there are some universals that lots of people have identified. The problem is it's not quite enough to predict, you know, this piece of music will be liked by this person. It's kind of like a recipe. You could say, well, we know that the kinds of things people like tend to be relatively sweet and maybe have a little bit of a creamy texture and have some fruit in them. That's, you know, a general description of a dessert. But does everyone like strawberry shortcake? Well, not necessarily.
I'd like to dig into that idea a little bit more, because we do know that human beings, for the most part, do crave either salty, fatty, sweet foods as a sort of something they developed evolutionarily for survival. Are there theories about what sort of evolutionary purpose music would play in the development of human beings?
That's a very good question, because unlike food, the one big difference is that you can't actually live without music. You might not have a very pleasant life, but you won't starve to death without it the way you would without having any food. And so one of the ideas that we're kicking around is that the reason we get such pleasure from music is because basically the brain can be thought of as a problem-solving engine or a prediction engine. In other words, we derive pleasure from solving puzzles, from understanding relationships, from seeing patterns in our environment, and from predicting what's going to happen next. And that does make sense from a survival point of view. If you are some kind of organism living in a certain environment and you can detect certain patterns that are out there and make predictions about what's going to happen, that will enhance your survival. And music can be thought of as a microcosm of that, to the extent that there are all kinds of different patterns, rhythms and harmonies and melodies and different kinds of relationships. And if you are able to perceive those relationships, you can also make predictions about what's coming up. So a big part of music is what musicians refer to as anticipation. So you hear a certain chord sequence, let's say, and you expect a certain chord to follow, and musicians will play with that by perhaps giving you a somewhat unexpected chord,
mm-hmm.
or by delaying when that particular chord appears.
Well, certainly not all music is designed for that dopamine surge or wash of pleasure that you get when you listen to something that you love. Here's a composition called Threnody for the Victims of Hiroshima. This is by the composer Penderecki. Listeners might actually recognize it from the film adaptation of Stephen King's The Shining. Okay, so it puts my neck hairs on edge. What does your research tell you about music that is purposefully dissonant, like this piece, which seems to be designed to make us feel uncomfortable?
Absolutely, and that is clearly the intent of that piece of music. So I would say that there are many different routes into evoking an emotional response, and pleasure is one very important one, but it's not the only one. And in some cases, the intended emotion is not pleasure, and that's true for music, but also true for many other styles of art. So in the case of that piece of music, for instance, it's highly, highly dissonant. People generally prefer consonant music. So if you have something very dissonant, by definition, it will be something that people find aggressive or unpleasant. If you look at a lot of music that is produced by and for very young people, you will also find a lot of dissonance, and that is consistent with the fact that adolescents are often, pretty sort of unhappy with their state, the way they see the world and the way they see themselves fitting in. And so they use music, and dissonance in particular, to express, their dissatisfaction, if you will.
We're speaking with Dr. Robert Zatoria, a neuroscientist based at McGill, about how our brains are quite noticeably and directly influenced by music. Here's another clip. This is one of those songs that gives me a chill when I hear it. Illinois Jacquet, he's playing Thelonious Monk's Round Midnight on an oboe.
Thank you.
people get a dopamine response from different kinds of emotionally powerful music? I mean, why would we derive pleasure listening to a very sad piece of music or something that's angry? Emotions generally perceived as negative.
Well, I think that is an excellent question, and many artists will tell you that their goal is to put people in an uncomfortable place, and that certainly applies to music. The interesting aspect of music is that it's so abstract. In other forms of art, you can refer directly to an event or a thought or an interaction with a person, whereas music is just patterns of sounds, and yet they can also evoke sadness or fear or anger. Of course, we don't really know how that happens. It's a very active research area, but we do see that, for example, with music that people perceive to induce fear in them, we do see a recruitment of parts of the brain that are known to be associated with the fear response, like the amygdala, for example. A broader question is, you know, why do people like to listen to those patterns? And I think this speaks to the sort of the complexity of the human mind that, you know, we're not always happy. Sometimes we're sad. And to the extent that you can use music to elicit those moods and therefore allow you to reflect on your own internal response to those emotions, that can actually be extremely useful and extremely even uplifting.
I may be generalizing, but I have noticed that very, very technically gifted musicians are much more likely to be interested in prog rock or jazz or math rock, genres that use complicated timings and rhythms, like this song. This is a snippet of the song Atlas, and it's by the band Battles. So you mentioned earlier the kind of satisfaction of resolution of patterns, this advanced pattern recognition. Would music like this be satisfying to musicians for that reason?
Well, I don't know about that particular piece. I didn't really care for it personally. But
I'm kind of with you on that one.
Obviously, a lot of people do, and it's interesting about the different time signatures because, you know, there is music in different genres over the centuries that have used rather complex timings. I'm thinking of, you know, Dave Brubeck, who famously wrote pieces in 5 or in 11, but also Stravinsky, for instance, who had many, many pieces with extremely complex rhythms. And I think what's going on there is that as you, the listener, become more sophisticated in a particular genre, whether it be that style of rock that we just heard, or, you know, contemporary classical music, or some kind of jazz, or whatever it is, you become better at recognizing those patterns. And to the extent that the patterns are more complicated and maybe more hidden in the musical structure, discovering them is even more of a pleasure. Because if a pattern is really very simple and very obvious and very superficial, well, you'll listen to that music once or twice, and after that, it'll be all over. You've discovered everything there is to be discovered, and it's now boring. And that's actually what happens with a lot of, music that's really designed for mass consumption, you know, top 40 music or something. Whereas music that stands the test of time tends to be, in large part, music that's more complicated, where the barrier to entry is much higher.
Music can differ so much from one place to the other. I'm thinking of, you know, the sort of complexity of a gamelan composition in Indonesia to, you know, an American or a Euro pop song. Very different kind of tendencies. Does that suggest that there's something different about those brains?
Yes, absolutely. So culture plays an enormous role in the way we understand music, similar to that of how we understand language. If you were brought up listening only to Indian ragas, you will develop a very good sense for what's going on in that kind of music. And if you did not grow up listening to that, you may not quite understand what's going on because you don't have the brain mechanisms that are required to decode those patterns. So it really comes back to this idea of pattern recognition. You have to learn how to recognize those patterns, and that learning occurs more easily early on. And in fact, there's a lot of evidence that very young children, even babies, they start to learn the patterns of sound in their environment, whether it be gamelans or Chinese music or Afro-pop or whatever it is that they're exposed to. They will learn that at the same time or even earlier then when they start to figure out the language that they're exposed to.
So music can alter the brain, like a drug might actually alter the brain. Is it the same in that way, in that addiction, in the sense that we are maybe always trying to find new music that will recreate that same burst, that same high that we got from the stuff that we used to love?
Well, there is an element of what we call association. So music serves very well to remind us of past events. But I think I'm more struck by the fact that people love music for its own sake. It is its own reward, as it were. It's not really linked to some external event. I think it would be an oversimplification to claim that music is nothing but a kind of a drug that you get high from and it makes you feel good and that's it. In fact, in our latest studies, we've been finding that unlike drugs, what happens with music is that there's a very complicated interaction between those more ancient reward-related structures that are deep in the middle of the brain and these very evolutionarily recent and very highly advanced cortical structures where we have all kinds of knowledge stored. And I think in a way that's the essence of what music is. It connects us to the deepest aspects of our humanity while at the same time requiring a lot of pretty complicated cognition.
Dr. Zatori, I want to thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much, Virginia.
Dr. Robert Zatori, neuroscientist at the Montreal Neurological Institute, that's at McGill University. Much more about the work that he's done on music and the brain. Links are at wordofmouthradio.org. You made me very curious about what are the most played songs on your iPod.
Well, I have very atypical tastes. I'm an organist by training, so I sort of favor music that was written up to 1750.
Inspired by the explanation of how music influences the brain and the emotions, we turned to our Facebook page and asked you for your saddest song of all time. Well, grab some tissues. We collected many of your suggestions and created the world's weepiest compilation. Here's just a 2-minute sample.
It's been 7 hours and 15 days. I was happy in the haze of a drunken hour, but heaven knows I'm miserable now. Go home, live with your pain, leave alone. Together we've climbed hills and trees, learned of love and ABC, skinned our hearts and skinned our knees. Goodbye, my friend, it's hard to die without his lifelong friend. Puff could not be brave, so Puff, that mighty dragon, sadly slipped into his cave. Oh, you know that old trees just grow stronger and old rivers grow wilder every day. Old people just grow lonesome, waiting for someone to say hello in there.
Black bodies swinging in the southern.
Don't you know my name? If I saw you in heaven,
he stopped loving her today. It placed a wreath upon his door.
My city, old man, all tattered and torn, the forgotten heroes of a forgotten war.
All the lonely people, the dude.
they all come from.
Thank you so much for your suggestions. You'll find a full list of the songs and the artists that made the world's weepiest compilation on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And we got so many that we couldn't fit them all. Did we miss any of your most potent weepers? You can let us know on our Facebook page, Facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. I'm Virginia Prescott. There are so many great ideas being passed around word of mouth. We'll be back with more next week on NHPR and online anytime at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcasts and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
Follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
And check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.